Greetings and welcome to season two of Life and Anthem. Kimberly Gunn with Zoom Catchers, and we're here with Lily Forrester. Super excited to be opening season two with this conversation, crypto, digital currency, and conversation. So Lily, how are you doing today?
I'm pretty good. It wouldn't be Life and Anth if I didn't say hello and welcome back to Life and Anth. I'm super excited to be here for season two. I know we took a little break, we changed the model, and I think I'm super excited to sort of dive in with this large topic today.
We are too, because I know a lot of people are hearing about it, like cryptocurrency, bitcoins, this, that, and the other. There's like a very kind of top line overview that a lot of people have of that. So I'm really excited to hear more about it. I've learned a lot just from our conversations offline, and we're here to help educate people who might also be interested in this topic. So my first question is, how did you decide to pick this topic for the season opener?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Bitcoin and cryptocurrency is such a huge topic, sort of at the national political level right now. It's something that is starting to pop up in a lot of headlines. There has been a conference where some of our largest political figures have been keynote speakers, and really a lot of breaking news in the crypto field with regards to large members of that community getting arrested, serving prison sentences, walking free again, and just a crazy development in a sort of tight timeline, and just being interested in economic anthropology in a larger sense, and also not having discussed economic anthropology on the show yet, since it is a little bit more layered and advanced than you might find in a 101 class, I thought, what better way to open up than to keep it current? So that's how I got here with the cryptocurrency.
Awesome. So it's crypto, cults, and conversations. You know, it's a fascinating convergence of a lot of different things. Thanks for being here. So my first question is, let's break it down for people. And if you could just give us an overview of what exactly is a cryptocurrency.
Sure. I mean, I'm going to try my best. You know, I think it's a cryptocurrency. I think you can understand it insofar as you understand a credit card. You know, I mean, you don't understand all of the fine details of working when you swipe your credit card. But basically, cryptocurrency it's completely digital. It's not backed by a financial institution. It's not backed by a good necessarily. So it's not founded in like gold or silver. It is created and maintained on computers. So essentially, it is like the giant digital ledger of exchanges that never actually really enters the physical realm at all. And because of that, because it is according to a complex algorithm, there's allegedly, I don't fully understand how this is possible, but a maximum of 21 million 21 million Bitcoins ever eligible to be mined. There is like a finite number that you can find, exchange, and they can increase in value, but you cannot essentially create more than the 21 million that are available. And because of this, it is viewed to be outside the fiat system of exchange. And therefore, within the community, it is viewed to be non-corruptible by large institutions.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. And you did, touch on something that I want to bring up as well, and that's fiat currency. If you could just explain the difference between, digital currency versus a fiat currency. I know a lot of people have heard that term, but what exactly is a fiat currency?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's something that we're going to have to discuss. It's necessary. You really can't have the crypto conversation without discussing the fiat system. But if you open up your wallet and you have your credit card, you have a couple of dollar bills, those are considered part of a currency that are viewed to be within the fiat system. And basically what that means is the value of that item, so that dollar bill, is determined by the perception of the value. So, when you say like the US dollar is strong, it is based on market trends, and market trends are based on consumer perception. And so largely what they are saying when they say that crypto is outside the fiat is that the perception of how much it's worth is not impacting the actual worth of the Bitcoin, and therefore it's non-corruptible. So they think that governments are endlessly printing dollars and that they're creating inflation and they're manipulating the market for their own benefit to drain the citizens' bank accounts for the betterment of the institution. And they think that, the fiat system is highly manipulable in this way. And so that's the thinking with the fiat system, is that if it is based on, what people perceive its value to be, then it will be necessarily corrupted by large institutions such as the government, such as politicians, such as banks, centralized banks, to make those political elites wealthier and to essentially stop any common people from entering that realm of financial wellness.
It's also interesting because you have, the economics and the political scene and then the cultural stories as well. And it seems like it's all kind of come together and really picked up speed over the past probably what, 5 years or so.
I would say yes. Yeah, it's been around for longer than that, but the last 5 years have had kind of rapidly accelerated the amount that we talk about cryptocurrency.
So that leads me to the next underpinning part of this conversation, and that's cults and cult-like activities, because you're kind of linking these ideas together. So just lay out what are some of the cult-like activities that you've noticed in this, or that has been noticed in this realm, and how does that fit into this conversation?
Yeah, absolutely. And always in Life Finance, we like to go to the experts, to the people who are actually living it, and to get some clips from them just talking about, what their experience is with it. Because as we know in anthropology, the people who are actively within that culture are the experts of it. So because I don't actually have connections with people who are engaged in Bitcoin or cryptocurrency to this degree, I have taken a more, and I thought this appropriate, a more digital approach to it. And I have sort of scraped Reddit for conversations among the community. And I wanted to start there because I think that this sets it up well. So, first of all, there are symbols within the community. And this is one thing that is sort of cult-like. And I think that we can't move forward without stating, what is a cult? What is a community? What is a religion? And I want to keep it strictly anthropological. So if we can take like all of the cultural connotations and remove them and strip them down to sort of a basic set of characteristics for each of these terms, I would say a cult is, anthropologically speaking, not inherently negative. Oftentimes the end result is negative, but that the what it is not inherently negative. So we can say a small, cohesive group, and they're organized around a set of beliefs, symbols, practices, and they're generally set apart from mainstream society. So I think that's like a really, really big distinction there. So while you might have a community, let's say that I'm defining that anthropologically as people connected by a shared identity, location, or interest, we're going to call a cult a small, high commitment group organized around one belief or truth. And we'll define a religion as an organized system of sacred beliefs and practices linked to the transcendent. So while religion is largely speculative about things we can't understand based on what was displayed to us directly on Earth, cults tend to be small groups that have more like single issue platforms and tend to be about achieving some sort of higher status, either in the afterlife or in the present life. And communities just sort of lacking that general motive, communities being more so just a group of people who are together either by happenstance, by living in the same place, or because they actually share a similar interest. So that's why I would say we're discussing this orange pill evangelism in the cult category. They are single issue. They are primarily concerned with transforming the financial institutions, decentralizing it. And because it is, in the grand scheme of things, although growing very rapidly, still a very small group. And because of their rejection of the fiat system and the current financial institutions, they are set apart from mainstream society.
So that's very interesting. So those are just kind of some basic cult-like activities or a way to define them. Question for you. Can you explain exactly the orange pill phenomenon? I know some people have heard
Yes.
about it, and I know they may have heard about it in a different context. So exactly what are you referring to there?
Sure, absolutely. So, this is a loose reference to The Matrix, and the idea is, truthfully, I'm not actually that familiar with The Matrix, but I can explain orange pilling. So, back to the Reddit thread, I'm going to read a little excerpt from a conversation here, wherein the original poster is asking if they can get rid of the term orange pilling. They think it sounds negative, that it's setting them further apart from mainstream society and perhaps alienating potential converts. This is a joke that comes from one user. They say, "Ding dong, do you have a minute to talk about our Lord and Savior, Satoshi Nakamoto?" I want to add a caveat here that Satoshi Nakamoto is a presumed pseudonym for who we believe is either the person or group of people who created Bitcoin, although it is unverified. So, ding dong, do you have a minute to talk about our Lord and Savior, Satoshi Nakamoto? No, I prefer ding dong, yo bro, have a sec for some orange pilling? And they say, okay, seriously. Orange pilling is how convinced Bitcoiners talk to other Bitcoiners about what many perceive as revelation when they learn not only about Bitcoin, but also about fiat. We have a reply here and says, another user says, if this is someone's reasoning for thinking Bitcoin is a cult, they've read a book by its cover. They will get the price they deserve when their FOMO as the price, and more importantly, adoption continues. Bitcoin is a hard pill to swallow because it involves a lot of knowledge and information that is fundamentally contrary to the world we've been raised in. Inflationary, corruptible fiat money is literally the thing destroying civilization on a track of unsustainability and yields over life logic. Decentralized, deflationary digital money takes us into the future humanity has never known. We've never had a truly trustless and inclusive money for anyone, anywhere. You don't know this stuff until you know it. The orange pill term originates from above realities and the correlations it shares with the matrix. Bitcoin isn't a suit and tie. It's not a big corporate HQ or institution or bank. It's just people, a totally free market, arguably the freest. So, this is what they believe to be the hard pill to swallow, is that the only way forward is to completely reject the financial institutions as they are, as completely corrupt, and fully engage in digital currency, and if they don't, that they will result in financial ruin.
Interesting. It's just a fascinating concept because I know, people have been talking about decentralization of a lot of things for decades now, and I guess my question is, because there's a lot going on. There's the digital current, there's currency, so there's money and economics, and then there's religion, and then there's this online aspect to it. And my question is, based on what you've observed and what you've studied, has the religious aspects of our society fueled the growth of these digital currencies?
So, religious aspects. So, I mean, anthropologically speaking, the answer would have to be yes. I mean, they have looked for a prophet, a messiah, a lot of sort of stand-in religious pseudo figures, people they are worshiping. Although, by this definition, we are going to categorize this more cult-like than it is religious, largely because there's not so much an aspect of this that is transcendent. So, this is not so much about life after Earth, or life beyond Earth, or beyond what's seen. It is more centered on this core philosophy that the members of Bitcoin carry, that we're being lied to, essentially, that we're being manipulated, and that there are heroes who are walking among us and who are being actively punished. That would be like SBF, Sam Bankman-Fried. That would be Ross Ulbricht, the Silk Road. and these political prisoners or martyrs, that they're really actually truth tellers who are walking among us, trying to help us see the light, and they're being punished by the big corporate, big political machine.
Interesting. So they're positioning these people as, heroes, and they took one for the team kind of idea.
Absolutely, absolutely. So much so that there are, if you go to a Bitcoin conference, which I personally have not gone, this is all hearsay and photograph, but there are shrines dedicated to these political martyrs as they view them, and the honor of them. And so a lot of worship, and that is definitely something that we would categorize as. Now, shrines could be either religious or cult-like, and in this case, because of the key characteristics I laid out, we're defining as more cult-like.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I know in our offline conversation you talked about that. There was some conferences, and there's like a thrones in the middle of rooms, and people are sitting on the thrones. If you could talk about that, just sort of like the ritualistic aspects of this, that would be helpful.
Yeah, so that's what I think is really fascinating about this topic as well. Historically, any sort of cult that has arisen has been the result of physical access to the members. And that's something that is really defining about this new era where we're all getting very globalized. We have such easy access to each other. I mean, even right now, you and me, we are sitting on the opposite sides of the country having this conversation, discussing the rise of the digital community or cult. And we're not physically present with each other. Cults do require easy access. The people who are, if they are evangelizing, they need to have access to people. And historically, the people you have access to are the ones who are right around you. We're just not in that era anymore. Now, Zoom Catchers has been successful at creating a network and community dedicated to this new world that we're in, and that's an amazing side effect of that globalization. But it can also be corrupted, and now it is much easier to evangelize for these sort of conspiracy ideas without actually ever speaking directly face to face with a person. This is where you get things like pipelines. This is where you get like these Reddit communities. This is where you get these Bitcoin communities, which are almost entirely online and separate. So these people can be like removed from society without ever being with the in-group physically. The in-group is there maybe signs, symbols that they wear to represent. So if you're walking about in your day-to-day life, another member of that community can spot you and recognize you. But by far and away, this is an online group, with one exception that they come together for an annual conference this year, Bitcoin 2025, in the US was in Vegas, and people are traveling from all over the globe to meet up at this conference. And this is the one really in-person organized event for this group. And they, like I said, had shrines for SBF, for Ross Ulbricht. They're celebrating the Silk Road creator, Ross, for his bravery, for going against the machine, and essentially for being a political martyr for, speaking truth to power. And just to highlight how impactful this is. One thing that I think is hard for me to parse out as somebody who is not in group is this idea, like I've said, that this currency is non-corruptible. It's deemed to be unreachable by large powers. And yet, some of the keynote speakers at the Bitcoin 2025 conference were JD Vance, Eric Trump, Donald Trump Jr. Some of the largest names in politics right now. So it is something that I was curious about looking into more, and how did this come to be? Because these two ideas, that it's unreachable by politicians and that the Trump family and administration is profiting so heavily off of it, they're incompatible in my mind. And that's what led me there. And just as a key piece of my positionality as well. That's what brought me here. I am not in group, and that's why I think, exploring that incompatibility and trying to have sort of an open mind about how this came to be is where I'm coming at this from.
It's really interesting because I think for me, I want to, play devil's advocate just a little bit. It's good to do that because there's, these digital currencies, they're out, they're considered investments, and so people have them. I think there was some piece of legislation that was signed also related to digital currencies. And so, where do you see the issues or the concerns? I mean, because some people are like, well, I have some bitcoins, I bought them legitimately, I'm using them, some people get paid in salaries in them. Where are the concerns that you see with this rise of the digital currency and the online communities specifically?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is I would say for starters, and it's hard to even know where to begin with this, but there are sort of two groups, and it's a spectrum between these two groups of engagement with Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies. There are people who, through like let's say the Robinhood app or some entry-level investment app, they have purchased some fraction of a Bitcoin. Usually, some fraction of a Bitcoin, because now we're talking about six figures of value. So, typically, people who are getting into this, it is part of a larger portfolio of stocks, and it's just one piece. These are not people who would be considered in-group by the maximalist Bitcoin users I'm discussing. And I do believe there is a spectrum. However, it does seem that you have to cross a threshold to be in-group, that you have either taken the orange pill or you haven't. People you are discussing, the more commonplace Bitcoin investor, they do not reject centralized bank institutions. They have most of their money in legitimate stocks, and they would not be considered in-group. If they were to attend the Bitcoin conference, they would be somebody to evangelize to. So we would break that into somebody who would get evangelized to, and somebody who would evangelize would be, the maximalist Bitcoin users that we are discussing today. And what I see as a risk with being a maximalist Bitcoin engager, if we can call it that. There's this sort of trust in the algorithmic authority of Bitcoin, that it is too complex to hack, that because it is so computer science forward, that it is created by and for smart people, and that, essentially that the companies cannot hack it. This is not true so far. I'm not sure, Kim, if you're familiar with the Cambodian prisons where they hold the scammers who do pig butchering scams.
No,
Okay.
I am not.
Okay.
Please enlighten
Yes.
me.
So this is another reason I thought this project was actually really important. So you're familiar with pig butchering scams, though, correct?
No, I am not.
No worries. All right. So this is also part of the digital era. This is like a new form of scam. And pig butchering gets its name because before you butcher a pig, you want it to be as fat as possible. So they basically are saying that they're finding people who are going to be susceptible to certain forms of scamming, and then they are going to nurture it until they have invested quite a lot of money in whatever it is that you want them to before you drain the account. So, have you ever been sitting at home and received a text that just said, "Hello"?
Yes.
Yes, okay, we all have. What you may not know is that behind that text is probably a person who has been held captive, more than likely in Cambodia. In these, they are prison-like in that these people cannot exit the facilities, and they are waiting for somebody to essentially take the bait. So you may have received a text at some point that said, "Hey, are we still on for golf tomorrow?" And then, if you reply, "Who is this?" that's actually considered something of a soft lead. and they'll continue nurturing this lead. So these people are held to incredibly high quotas. They have to scam for millions of dollars, and they have extreme consequences if their quotas are not met. So basically, and it probably is with a large range of cryptocurrencies that they're asking people to invest in. But the one that is very high profile at the moment is Tether. So Tether is a cryptocurrency that is, as its name suggests, it is tethered to the value of the US dollar. So it is pitched as a stable crypto investment in a decentralized institution. It is considered to be a more steadfast way to earn money through crypto, or it is pitched as that, particularly by these pig butchering scammers. So the risk that I see with this is the idea that it's uncorruptible, that it's an untouchable kind of currency. It's just actually, it's verifiably untrue, and yet people respect the authority of the algorithm more than the actual evidence of its failure. So, we're looking at these people who are being held in modern slavery in these Cambodian scam rings, which have been responsible for $37 million in scams. And it's an unregulated financial institution, Tether, collaborating with political elite in Cambodia. So, we can turn a blind eye and just say, I continue to trust the algorithm because the fiat system is broken and it's going to cost us all millions. Or, we can start addressing the actual facts here, which is that not only is this currency not non-corruptible, but it is actively being corrupted.
Sam Bankman-Fried isn't here, a classic example of corruption in that space, and there's quite another. I remember a couple of years back there was some mysterious person or one of these companies, Mt. Gox, and there seems like some of the people behind these institutions are unidentifiable. They have kind of anonymous, kind of what do you call it, mysterious personas, and you can't really identify
Exactly.
them. And I'm like, that should be a tip off everybody.
Yes, and instead of it being a tip off, this is what I'm saying, the myth is something that really adds to this sort of cult-like characteristic of the Bitcoin maximalist community. Like I said, there is a presumed pseudonym for the creator or creators, we're unsure, of Bitcoin, that is Satoshi Nakamoto. And it really adds to the sort of perceived lore of it, that this is not some huge institution, but really just a common man who created Bitcoin, a currency for the people. And that if you adopt it, will be wealthy. And if you continue on with the fiat system, you'll enter financial ruin.
Interesting. So that's the frame, because I was just curious, like anthropologically speaking, the economic anthropology, which I didn't even know really existed, what how they weigh in on the concerns about it, because it seems like to me, if you look at our current dollar, I mean, it's pick up any dollar bill and it says, "In God we trust," so there's been this connection with religion, for a long time now. Where specifically do economic anthropologists see this all headed, and what are the sort of mitigations to that are people recommending if they are?
Yeah, I think the great struggle with this kind of phenomenon is how complex the underpinnings are. I opened the episode saying I really can't explain Bitcoin in that great detail. I can tell you it is decentralized, that it's online, and that it is not backed by, large institutions, that there's no physical value to it. But I really can't tell you what the algorithm is doing. And historically, that has, like I said, algorithmic authority. It's held quite a lot of power in society. And this idea that there is an expert out there who just simply knows more than you, the fact that we can accept that as people without many further questions means that that person will always sort of wield that power in a way. And so that's how we get these tech CEOs being kind of a proxy for a messiah in a way. This is not directly tied to any one religious leaning. It is more so. So as you're saying, yes, the dollar says in God we trust, which is definitely an enmeshment and an entanglement of church and state. And I think that where we start to see a peel off is not so much that the Bitcoin maximalists object to the enmeshment of church and state, more so that they object to state and economy enmeshing, and that they don't want a circumstance in which the US government, which they view to be deeply corrupt, can rip them off. And that's this great distrust in the machine and the great trust in the algorithm is how we end up with these Bitcoin maximalists who can't explain the product but believe in it deeply.
And I think I think it's important to acknowledge that, there are, trust in the institutions has eroded, and that's a real thing. I mean, people are seeing corruption in real time, like every day, right? So it's we understand that part, and so it seems like it's the perfect frame for people to be like, well, don't believe those people over there, come believe us. And I have never really understood. There's some things about this digital currency that I don't understand. What how people take real currency money that's insured, in a bank by a bank, or yeah, insured by a bank for up to $250,000. You take real money and invest it in digital currency, which isn't insured. So it's just an interesting concept to me, and I understand it's perceived as, an investment in stock. That's one thing. And I do not understand, and I don't know if you could explain this, how the blockchain works. And I've tried.
Yes, we might have to call in somebody with a little bit more expertise than me to explain how the blockchain works.
It's
I
all,
did.
I mean, because that's an underpinning of it, right? The blockchain.
Absolutely. Yeah, and that's exactly sort of the lore that I'm referring to is that some people may be able to try to give some like elementary explanation of how the blockchain works, but there are few people who can really deeply explain it. And that is because it is so, as I said, in layman's terms, it's very computer science forward. The blockchain is, I've heard it explained in some form or another as a giant digital ledger. The idea being that you really never have to put money in if there is always a ledger of who owes who how much. And so the idea of the blockchain, we're going to call in an expert on this to explain in more detail. But essentially with digital currencies, you can bypass a financial institution if everybody is publicly aware of all of the exchanges that are being made. I wish I could explain it in great detail. I wish I could explain exactly what mining was. And
I
how
was going
that's
to ask.
possible. Yes, I wish I did try my best, but I'm afraid that you might have to go to someone who's actually an anthropologist, preferably, who has actually dedicated years of study to this topic about the nitty-gritty details of blockchain. My interest is more so, and my focus is more so in the culture that surrounds it, rather than the actual minute details of how it works. We might need extra months to prepare if if I wanted to give you hard and fast.
Oh, no worries. It's just something that I've actually really tried to understand. I've actually, gone and read articles and watched videos, and it's just there's, I don't know, maybe it's me, but it feels like there's something about it that is quite ethereal. And there's a lot of people out there that are like, oh, it's hard to explain, which I think is kind of questionable. And so
Yes.
that's
Yeah, and that's where we get this great divide, which is that some people view something hard to explain, and they say this is untrustworthy, and then other people view something difficult to explain, and they say that somebody who can explain it is some form of deity, that they have power that we who cannot explain it do not have, and therefore are trustworthy sources.
Which is, it's like the perfect setup for, oh, don't believe them, come believe us, because, we understand and you don't need to understand, trust me. And it's kind of it feels like, generally speaking, there's a lot of opportunity for fraud and corruption in this space because of these people that are unidentified and no one knows who they really are, and concepts that are hard to understand. I'll put it that
Absolutely.
way.
Yeah. I mean, it's an extremely divided time, and I think that in many ways, crypto has sort of come into the limelight as just yet another issue that we are divided on. And you know, much like there are fringe members of each movement who are very extreme in political groups, in all kinds of like religious groups, this is a fringe sector of crypto investors who have made it essentially their entire life to be a member of this group. Like I said, they're socially sort of set apart from the mainstream, and they are evangelical. And for, you know, these reasons, I do think that there is a bit of a danger because, you know, if they are given quite a lot more legitimacy, it's just very easy to access people these days in the digital world. You know, it's great that we're globalized, and in many ways, it is introducing many more dangers that we're globalized. And I think this sort of digital cult, you know, it's one of them. It's not the only one. And we're gonna continue to see them pop up in many different forms. So I think that that's, you know, the sort of central tenet here. I just would warn that pipelines online are very pervasive. That just because somebody seems to have a lot of information and wield a lot of respect online does not necessarily mean that they're non-corrupted.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, you touched on something so interesting where, you know, there's this worshiping of this technology and you see it with AI. And I guess, you know, Bitcoin probably, these digital currencies are probably relying heavily on AI as well. And I'm always just really leery of that because, you know, I don't want to be worshiping. First of all, I don't really want to be worshiping anything, you know. So let's go there. And second of all, I just don't feel like we all should be kind of skeptical of that, you know, putting certain people on these pedestals and why it just feels like it lays the groundwork for all kinds of potential corruptions and problems and frauds and online issues. And you know, I was just thinking, we were talking about when you were mentioning the pipelines and the online communities. There was a while back, maybe a couple months ago, I kept getting these crypto investment threads to my phone. I was getting these texts. And it was like, hey, join this thread. Hey, and it was going on for probably like a month or two. Every now and again, this thread would pop in. And that's, you know, that's one of my questions is how are they connecting with people? Is it just random phishing and or just putting out their texts and people are like, oh, this is interesting, and then they're clicking and then they're now down a rabbit hole?
Yeah, well, those are most likely scams, actually. So, like, most likely you're dealing with a more direct form of that, you know, sort of pig butchering scam that I was mentioning before. Typically, with the most classic case, it is not off a thread that directly reveals itself out of the gate as crypto related. But there is, like I said, a lot of like, there are high quotas at these scamming rings, and people fire off thousands of touch points. So the fact that everyone is receiving these texts, you know, most likely there is some form of dialer or random number generator that is contacting as many people as possible in the hopes that they'll just get a click. And this is sort of a side effect of cryptocurrency in a way, that in many of these cases, you're not legitimately investing in crypto. You're putting your money where somebody is going to then drain it. So, you know, it is not necessarily that those are genuine evangelizers. Those are probably scammers who are taking advantage of the fact that people have a limited understanding of cryptocurrency, taking advantage of the fact that people are really susceptible to get rich quick schemes. They are taking advantage of the fact that people have this algorithmic authority that somebody who can explain Bitcoin and who can explain cryptocurrency in words that you don't totally understand, functionally gibberish, but because it sounds technical, people believe it. And then they're susceptible to getting scammed, which is, you know, not a feature of Bitcoin maximalism itself, but rather that the decentralized nature of cryptocurrency has a sort of secondary negative effect, which is that it becomes very difficult to understand what is a legitimate financial venture and what is definitely a scam.
It sounds like the old adage, caveat emptor, buyer beware, is definitely something that
Yes.
is something we should all think about. Wow, this has been such a fascinating conversation. We're here with Lily Forrester, with Life in Anth, season two opener, and I think it's a great way to open up the season with this conversation. And then, if you could just kind of summarize, because we've talked about a lot of different things, why is anthropology a good lens to look at this situation?
I think absolutely. Anthropology, we always say if people do it, we study it. And I think anthropology is really a lens for us to look at everything through, but so often neglected are financial institutions, so often neglected are the economics and political landscapes that we're existing in. And, I think that's sort of difficult to overlook in a time like this one where there is the first ever legitimate threat to the current standing financial institution. And the early adopters have formed a community. They have formed a culture. And really, anthropology is the study of culture. So when we look at this anthropologically, I think that there's a lot of why that we miss when we look at it from other lenses. So, why are people susceptible to this kind of messaging? Why, like, what in the larger political landscape is causing people to seek other forms of financial paths forward? What other groups might these people be a part of, and why are those overlapping? That kind of question is often missed in a more hard science look, or even just straight economic look at the rise of Bitcoin. And I think that so many times with economy, we forget that it is strictly determined in so many ways by people and the decisions that people make. And that's why I think, when we talk about anything economy related, anthropology should be involved in the conversation.
I agree, and I can't wait to see how this conversation and this situation continues to unfold. I have a feeling there's going to be some continued fallout with this. It just feels like whenever there's these huge bubbles and a lot of energy involved in these types of investments, there's some bust coming. I'll just say that. I could be wrong, but if you go back and look at these types of scenarios, it's oftentimes something right around the corner. So we'll stay tuned. And do you want to give us a sneak peek into the rest of season two? What else you got coming down the pipeline?
Yeah, down the pipeline. I mean, I think that we're gonna take a turn away from cult conversation, and we'll dive into large scale religion conversation. I'm excited about that one. One of my favorite classes I ever took was an examination of religious anthropology. And I thought, much like this sort of cult-like conversation, it can be very isolating. I found that discussing religious issues as they intersect with anthropology is actually really uniting. So I think I'm excited to talk about religious anthropology. We're gonna take a look at NGOs and how they interact with our government, why they exist, and how we can better them. And I'm open to feedback from my listeners as well as we build out further.
Thank you so much. I'm excited and can't wait to see what you come up with next, because every time I get these notes, I'm like, this is fascinating. Because I mean, so much of it is this very, I think the way specifically the way the digital currency is being talked about in the general media is from strictly investment terms and how it's doing, and maybe if someone was arrested or there's an investigation or something, but not really kind of digging deeper into how and why and how did we get here and things of that nature. And it feels like with anything, there's a lot going on behind the scenes that we're not really privy to. So this is very helpful to dig into the weeds and understand. Looking forward to the next topics. And please feel free to go back and look at season one. We talked about a lot of different things that I'm sure will catch your attention. And any final thoughts before we head out?
I think that I can't leave my listeners without telling them to go ruin some parties with your newfound knowledge.
You can tell them all about Bitcoin Jesus and the orange pill, and ask them if they're still mining. How's that?
Absolutely.
thank you so much for being with us today, and we'll see you next time.
All right, see you next time.